Is economic development bigger than economists? Virek Prum. It is neither new nor profound to say that a country will become rich if there are more goods and services produced at home. Countries that have high development needs tend to have countless opportunities for productive investments which actively contribute to GDP. A famous scholar on China's economic development model, Michael Pettis of Peking University, has relentlessly been explaining China's past miracle to all those wanting to know. Recently, he even came to give a talk to students at CAMED Business School on the very topic. If the so-called investment-driven growth model is of any guide, sustained annual growth over the years may well travel within the known orbit. But this can become a source of concerns in the long run, as it has long been acknowledged that the economic growth model as applied in China, according to Pettis, necessarily means that the average Chinese households haven't consumed enough for so long, same issue in Japan previously following their asset bubble burst, which has led to deep imbalances that keep noted economists talking. Credited for having coined the term balance sheet recession to characterize the stark stagnation that started to trap Japan in the 1990s following three decades of economic growth, balance sheet recession, 2003, Richard Ku believes that his recession theory also explains the phenomenon in China. At the core of his argument, this type of recession would occur when corporations try to repair their balance sheets by mainly paying down debt rather than borrowing to invest, even when there are profitable investment projects. Paying down debt is a rational and responsible thing to do, but the problem is when everyone does this at the same time. In his most recent book, Ku shows that Japanese companies refuse to borrow even at zero interest rates, thereby collectively throwing the whole economy into a recession for over 15 years, Pursued Economy, 2022. Elsewhere, cases of housing bubbles that occurred in 2008 in the US and in many parts of Europe prior are well documented. Clearly, no cocktail parties could go on forever. The misfortune is not knowing when to stop the free flow of drinks. Hard to stop when you're having fun, even if the hangover from prolonged parties is often unpleasant. Why? Because rebalancing the economy requires very painful adjustments as, according to Michael Pettis, the very economic model that guaranteed the marvelous annual growth years after years will need to be reversed. Right there lies the biggest challenge. Trying to reverse the status quo is never going to be easy. Vested interests that have hugely benefited from the system would object in every step of the way. Nevertheless, in Avoiding the Fall published in 2013, Pettis vividly warns how Chinese debt utilized to fund the investment-driven growth model had become unsustainable. Among various remedies he was evaluating, one trick to help China rebalance would be by increasing household consumption, which had steadily been declining. This option, of course, is very hard to implement, as he explains in more detail in The Great Rebalancing, also published in 2013. Not seeing a sufficient progress, in his later book published in 2020 called Trade Wars or Class Wars, Pettis then cautions against potentially non-productive investments. He couldn't be clearer when he reaffirms what he has said previously that, the only sustainable solution is to reduce the economy's reliance on investment spending by raising domestic consumption. That means radically altering the distribution of wealth and income so that Chinese households can afford what they produce. Trade Wars or Class Wars, page 127, emphasis added. In other words, Pettis wants to see a mechanism in place to generate transfer of wealth to households. In its basic form, GDP is, roughly speaking, savings plus consumption. Thus, it follows that for GDP growth to remain at a targeted rate and in order for consumption to rise, savings, therefore, investments, would have to drop. Pettis often makes this point almost every time he speaks about China's road to readjustments. But any appeal to alter economic policy at that scale would have to face legacy obstacles. Former Premier Wen Jiabao at a press conference in March 2007 referred to the situation back then as unsteady, unbalanced, uncoordinated, and unsustainable. Cited in The Great Rebalancing, page 71, reforming was surely going to take a lot of time. Most recently, when interviewed on Bloomberg TV on November 26, Richard Ku did not hesitate at all to opine that it would indeed take China many years to get out of what he has been calling a balance sheet recession, and quickly reminded us that it took Japan some 20 long years. If it is crucial to keep GDP growing at some desired rate, and since it has proven very hard to increase domestic consumption, it appears therefore that huge investment spending must still continue for a while. Indeed, The latest package of roughly $1.4 trillion, 10 trillion yuan, announced in early November this year is expected to help recapitalize banks and tackle with local governments' debt, so that the desired GDP wouldn't be affected. If anything, according to Ku's interview, China would need to inject more stimulus packages for as long as it takes. Appreciating a country's success story is certainly a beneficial exercise as it allows us to look back at what worked. In Trade Wars or Class Wars, Michael Pettis painstakingly looks back many decades and categorically divides China's rapid economic development into four stages, each dwelling on specific underlying conditions. But, along with this past success story, knowing that painful adjustments will have to be made should give anyone a pause. It unavoidably brings up the question of whether development should mainly be about economic growth. In fact, some even wonder whether the economy is best left to economists. Whatever your conviction is, GDP as a statistical tool can be oversimplifying or even misleading. In a recent feature article in the IMF's Finance and Development magazine, December 2024 issue, IMF chief statistician Bert Kroes in GDP in the Future passionately charges that GDP as a tool is actually incomplete and says almost nothing meaningful about the welfare of a society. Kroes then suggests that we include other more comprehensive tools. If his approach can help us rightly see the country in a more holistic manner beyond GDP growth, then Ha Jun Chang ought to be right in concluding that economics is a political argument and that the economy is too important to be left to professional economists. Economics, The User's Guide, 2014, pages 327-33. You can choose to disagree with Chang, but remember that there are, as explained in his economics book, 9 schools of economic thoughts out there. This plurality means that there is no one complete methodology. The different schools simply represent various sides of the argument, however articulated. Numbers simply don't capture the whole truth. After all, says Chang, the market is only one of many different ways of organizing the economy. Indeed, it accounts for only a small part of the modern economy, page 330, and that, virtually all economic success stories have been facilitated, if not necessarily orchestrated, by an active state. Page 290. And for all the active roles the state needs to play, a careful move would have to be much bigger than what economists think. Whether or not Michael Pettis and Richard Ku are correct in their prescriptions is for time to tell, but the fact remains that China's experiment with continuous adjustments should be felt well beyond Chinese borders.